on Freakonomics Radio, Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. You're listening to Radio Catskill, your NPR station for the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is a special Earth Day edition of Radio Catskill. Today, join Farm and Country's Rosie Starr and Radio Catskill student journalist Maren Scotton for a special report on the future of farming in our region. Who are the new farmers? What challenges do they face? The future of farming, next. First, the news from NPR.
News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. Former President Donald Trump has arrived to court in New York for his hush money criminal trial. Opening statements are beginning today. Heading into court moments ago, Trump said today is a very, very sad day for America. The U.S. Supreme Court today will consider whether cities can fine or jail people experiencing homelessness for sleeping outside. As NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports, the case stems from Grants Pass, Oregon.
Lower courts have said cities cannot punish people if there is not adequate shelter available for them, but most places don't have nearly enough, and Grants Pass says the rulings have hamstrung its efforts to keep public spaces safe and open for everybody. Advocates for unhoused people in the case say that fines and jail time only make it harder for them to eventually get housing.
NPR's Jennifer Ludden reporting. European Union foreign and defense ministers are holding a joint meeting in Luxembourg. Terry Schultz reports they're relieved the U.S. House approved a $61 billion aid package for Ukraine.
Ukraine's foreign and defense ministers urged their EU counterparts, meeting jointly, to follow up anticipated U.S. assistance with more of their own. Now that you're all here at the table, it's time to act, not to debate, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba said in a statement. Latvia's new foreign minister, Baiba Braža, agrees.
If Europe has the ambition to manage conflicts on its continent, this is a time to show that.
Ministers are also considering whether to further penalize Iran after its attack on Israel. There are already sanctions in place against Tehran for supplying missiles to Russia. These are likely to be expanded to include missiles and drones Iran has provided to its proxies in the Middle East. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
The Senate could vote on the aid package as soon as tomorrow. Stocks opened higher this morning as Tesla announced a new round of price cuts. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped about 70 points in early trading.
Tesla had already shaved about $2,000 off the price of several electric car models sold in the U.S. and now says it's cutting the price of its self-driving system by about a third. Drivers who use that system still have to remain alert and take the wheel occasionally. Tesla stock has fallen more than 40% this year. The United Auto Workers Union is hoping to make further gains in the South after a historic win in Tennessee last week. Volkswagen workers in Chattanooga voted overwhelmingly to join the union after two no votes in the last decade. The UAW is hoping to organize other non-union plants with votes scheduled at Mercedes-Benz in Alabama next month. Asian stocks were mixed overnight, up in Hong Kong but down in Shanghai. Scott Horsley, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. Climate change in Europe is getting a lot of attention on this Earth Day. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports.
The number of heat-related deaths has increased by at least 30% in the last 20 years, according to a new analysis by European Union and United Nations climate experts. That's in part because Europe is heating up twice as fast as the global average. Ocean and atmospheric currents, plus the continent's proximity to the rapidly warming Arctic, are causing temperatures to rise rapidly. Last year was tied for the second hottest year on record in Europe. European cities are scrambling to protect people from inevitable heat waves this summer by providing cooling centers and air conditioning. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
A new Olympics sports doping scandal has erupted less than 100 days before the Summer Games in Paris. Nearly two dozen athletes from China tested positive for a performance-enhancing drug before the last Summer Olympics, but the results were never disclosed. Columbia University is holding all classes virtually today in response to growing tension on campus. Pro-Palestinian student protesters camped out in tents and sleeping bags over the weekend. They are calling for the university to divest from companies connected to Israel. Reports of harassment against Jewish students at Columbia are now surfacing ahead of Passover. The Jewish holiday begins tonight at sundown. I'm Kristen Wright, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Procter & Gamble, maker of Align Probiotic, a daily supplement designed by gastroenterologists to help relieve occasional bloating, gas, and abdominal discomfort. More at AlignProbiotics.com.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
Welcome to the Future of Farming, a special presentation from Radio Catskill. I'm Rosie Starr, host of Farm and Country.
And I'm Maren Scotton, one of Radio Catskill's interns.
Today, we're taking a look into the next generation of farmers in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania, who they are, what's important to them, and what challenges they face in entering a notoriously difficult industry.
From accessing land, financial struggles, to learning the ropes of how to grow food, things aren't easy for beginner farmers. But if they're anything, it's determined.
To clarify, the United States Department of Agriculture defines beginner farmers as those who have operated a farm or ranch for 10 years or less. So, while many beginner farmers are quite young, there are also many who have turned to farming after having worked in an entirely different profession for most of their lives. Anna Bryden, the owner of Bryden Brook Farm in South Canaan, Pennsylvania, sort of stumbled into it after moving to Pennsylvania from Sweden.
We have a small family farm that we kind of started not really on purpose. I wanted chickens, and I always wanted sheep, but we haven't gotten that far yet. But we got sheep, ducks, and we do turkeys and pigs seasonally. Just feed a pig. So we buy the pigs from a farmer and then raise them over the summer and take them to the butcher in the fall. I'm from Sweden. And yeah, then moved to the U.S. and I met my husband and we've been married for 13 years. He's from Pennsylvania, Allentown, and he moved up here for a job. And I came to visit him here and I never left. Growing up, I always wanted sheep because I love to spin and knit. Like, I'm into fiber arts. I haven't had much time to do it now since I had kids. But that's something I would like to add to the farm eventually is some Swedish sheep. So I like to do things the old-fashioned way. It might be harder, take longer, and be more time-consuming. And it's a different way of life, but I like the old-fashioned, natural way, if at all possible. What I'm trying to do is go back to things that were written or histories about what did people do before industrialization? How did they manage their animals? Like open-air chicken farms, you don't close them up too much. The purpose of a chicken coop is to protect them from predators and a little bit from the environment. You don't want them to have rain and wind and stuff on them, but they need so much more ventilation than people think, and they don't need heat. So I'm just looking at, how did people do it a long time ago? Because those things, they were in place for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And it worked. So it's just one of those things that if something doesn't feel like it's natural or right, you're probably going to find someone to support you in that. And it may or may not be right. So as long as you're willing to put your money where your mouth is, You try something out, and it either works or it doesn't. If it doesn't work, you go back to the drawing board and you try something else. But it's just that experimentation and trying to read about what have other people done, trying to avoid the most common mistakes, and you're going to end up thinking that you know better and do some stupid things. But most of the time, I'm trying to think it through and work with nature, not against it. I mean, a pig's going to act like a pig. A chicken's going to act like a chicken. And as long as you realize that and you work with that, instead of trying to get them to reason, you can't tell them what to do. They're going to do what they think is best to do in that situation. So you just have to be flexible and figure out how you can use them. And I think one of the best things I heard was an interview where someone said, "Gravity has never failed me." I thought that was so fantastic or profound that it's, yeah, work with nature, not against it.
A desire to grow things the old way is a common value for beginner farmers. In a survey conducted by the National Young Farmers Coalition, 83% of beginner farmers nationwide said their primary reason for their farm's existence is for engaging in conservation or regeneration.
There are a number of organizations across the country that support farmers in using climate-friendly practices like PASA Sustainable Agriculture. PASA is an organization based in Pennsylvania that supports sustainable farms and equitable food systems through farmer-driven education, research, and community. Dan Dalton leads their farming training and development program.
PASA is a big tent or a large umbrella organization. You know, we're not explicitly certified organic or anything like that within our membership. We think that there are a lot of different ways forward to sustainability, and everyone, you know, in their farming systems and their farming journeys are kind of in their own place. So, yeah, I mean, we have conventional folks represented in the study. We have, you know, multi-generational farms, farms of many hundreds of acres down to, you know, very small scale. We just enrolled our first urban cohort in the Soil Health Benchmark study this last year. So, yeah, we see it insights and its value as being applicable really at all scales. Agriculture functions as a real nexus for sustainability and environmental sustainability specifically. And I think a lot of folks are seeing the potential in that. That can be in the form of, you know, diversified production, farming in ways that are more sustainable in terms of like soil carbon, livestock well-being and animal welfare concerns, things like that. And then there is this articulation of climate smart agriculture where, you know, we're looking at specific practices as having a significant potential positive impact on mitigating climate change in the future. And so we see a lot of farmers and we have a lot of interest from folks who want to learn about and engage with those practices. And so that's something that as an organization, we received a large federal grant 2 years ago, and over the next couple of years, we're going to be administering a lot of project dollars to support people in installing and trialing and tracking those practices specifically. It definitely takes a resilient person to engage with and stick with this work. I think it's a lot of it is folks seeing the potential and a lot of folks seeing the need and feeling empowered or compelled at least to engage with and try to pursue more sustainable ways of practice and find a way forward in agriculture. One of the things that I think contributes to keeping people in it and helping people be successful is sort of the approach that we as an organization take, which is really focusing on peer-to-peer support and peer-to-peer learning. Before we were even incorporated as an organization, we were founded or we were originally constituted as an annual conference of producers and sustainably minded growers who wanted to get together and share with each other. And so that has been and continues to be the core ethos of how we operate and how we, you know, aspire to support people. So the conference continues every February, early February in Lancaster. We get folks together for 4 days of intensive sharing out, substantially peer-to-peer learning. It functions both as a huge opportunity for knowledge exchange, but also, you know, community building, support, things like that. We have a very robust children's program. So farmers are able to attend with childcare. And the kids then also have a pretty robust program there in terms of learning about farming topics, and they get to go down to the trade show and things like that and actually engage with agriculture themselves. But I think as far as highlighting the way forward in terms of sustainable practice and supporting each other in doing so, I think that that peer-to-peer approach is what has been successful for us and has been core to us. And I think is really the way forward on a lot of fronts for advancing sustainable ag for new and beginning folks.
Despite using practices friendly for the earth, making it as a small-scale beginner farmer in a system that supports industrial agriculture isn't easy. Since 2009, the cost of farmland has nearly doubled. With the current generation nearing retirement age and over 40% of America's farmland, that's about 400 million acres, expected to change hands in the next decade, there are thousands of young and beginning farmers ready to take over. But many of them just can't afford land. And without stable access to land, you can't farm.
The sort of thing where, you know, they're not making any more land out there. And so I think folks who are either speculating for their own purposes or just see that as an opportunity are basically consolidating or scooping up what's available. We also know that development patterns around the state and around the country are gobbling up farmland at a pretty high rate for housing and for other development purposes. That comes down really to federal and more state and local policy in terms of identifying and preserving, you know, prime agricultural soils, which is one of the criteria for farmland preservation. But also agriculture tends to function in nodes. There tend to be agricultural communities that have, you know, suppliers and other retailers and vendors, technical support and all of that. And looking for some way to preserve those agricultural communities and to support them as a enduring agricultural communities, I think, is something that we should be looking into. The other thing sort of to that end, and that could also fit into the policy space, is that with so many folks getting into farming being first generation and not coming from generational farming, there's a lot of generational and intergenerational knowledge that gets lost when that transfer doesn't happen. You know, somebody doesn't grow up on the farm or leaves the farm and comes back at a later date. You know, there's just a loss of information. And that's where we see, you know, more structured farmer training and learning opportunities being really valuable, because it helps to support those farm learners in their early stages. And it really helps them answer many of the questions that are involved in farm startup so that they are more skilled, more agile, and more successful sooner, that they're not burning up their, you know, their enthusiasm, their startup capital, their networks and things like that on silly mistakes, that they're able to actually substantively engage with farming as a career as early and as soon as possible, hopefully from day one. So I would point to things like, you know, we have our registered apprenticeship and pre-apprenticeship programs. There are also farm incubator programs across the state. There are two that I'm thinking of that are helpful for folks to access shared capital and shared resources there in the form of equipment and leased land. I think college and university farms across the state have a role to play in this for folks who are looking to be in agriculture or agriculture adjacent careers. And then we also, as an organization, see a huge potential in urban agriculture and urban ag audiences as well, because the population is, you know, substantially urban in the country at this point. That's where most of the people are. And there are still, you know, many, many folks who are looking to engage with growing, farming, and where their food comes from. And supporting that audience, helping to train and cultivate them, we see as a real benefit going forward. Knowing that many will stay in or near cities and grow at a smaller scale, but that some percentage of them also are going to want to out-migrate and be able to scale up a little bit more and go to rural communities and take on some of this farmland that is being underutilized. We have been for a long time providing support to urban agriculture and urban farms and urban producers. Just see a lot of opportunity there. And I would encourage people not to overlook or sleep on urban ag and its potential. Folks in urban ag generally are working at quite small scale, but they also are facing, you know, huge headwinds in terms of getting sites fit for production, you know, whether it's past demolition practices, assessing sites for heavy metals and other contamination, just physically decompacting lots is a real challenge. But once that work is done and once sites have been developed and assessed, the value that that throws off to communities in the form of, you know, engagement, adult education, youth education, food access, culturally appropriate foods, things like that, and being responsive to the communities in which they're nested. I think it can't be and shouldn't be overlooked in terms of being a part of the future of agriculture. I also see some percentage of folks in urban ag need and want to scale up. And as an audience to be the successive generation of larger scale agriculture, I also think that there's a huge role to be played by them in it. And so in as much as we're able to provide support and understanding and bridge kind of the urban rural barriers that exist in various places, I think it would be to agriculture's benefit to do so.
There is a theme here. Beginner farmers are doing things differently, whether it be through urban farming or using sustainable growing methods. Beginner farmers are redefining what it means to grow food and how it's being done.
But regardless of how they start, whether it's on a one-acre plot in Brooklyn or a piece of land in Pennsylvania, farming isn't cheap. In the National Young Farmers Coalition survey, access to capital and loans was the second biggest challenge for beginner farmers, with 41% of respondents saying that accessing capital to grow their business was very or extremely challenging. Brent Habig, the owner of Two Creeks Farm, a 100-acre regenerative farm in northeast Pennsylvania, explains why it's so hard to get things off the ground.
I think as a beginner, you know, there's just kind of capital outlays anywhere you look. So you've got a lot of infrastructure expense. You got to pay through your learning curve on certain things. All of your animals, all of your feed, you know, so much of farming is pre-funded by the farmer, and then you make your money when and if you produce and sell that product. I think managing capital and investing in the right areas is critical to success as a new farmer. If you're a second generation farmer, you've got your tractor paid for, you've got all your infrastructure in place, you might need to invest in some new animals if you're going into a new area of farming. But so much of your farm is already in place, ready to go. So the upfront capital of kind of getting all that, I think, is much more difficult for new farmers. There's also getting your brand out. So it's a relatively crowded space. Getting into farmers markets can be very difficult. Many people might assume, hey, I've got a great product, some organic veg or some organic chicken, pastured this, and, you know, selling it will be the easy part, but it's pretty crowded. And so to get into the right markets that are close to you and to develop your customer base, that really takes a period of several years. If you don't have that, you can end up producing more than you can sell. I kind of feel like the actual act of production is the easiest part, and the financial management and the market building are harder and slower, involve more strategy, and really involve a multi-year long game about kind of how to make all that happen in a way that allows your farm to succeed. And we see a lot of attrition. A lot of new farmers come and go. There's quite a number of farmers put in a few years and either choose not to continue or are unable to continue, or some combination, and burnout is a huge problem because this takes an enormous amount of effort. Generally don't have the time to hire labor, and you're just out there slogging unbelievable hours, day after day, week after week, month after month. And at some point you're like, I can't keep doing this. So I know burnout's a big factor.
For Black farmers, accessing loans is even more difficult. The USDA has a long and documented history of discrimination towards Black farmers, denying them access to loans, grants, and other forms of assistance, which have contributed to a significant decline in Black-owned farms. In 1920, there were nearly 100 million black farmers nationwide. Today, black farmers number around 40,000.
According to USDA data, from 2018 to 2023, the national rejection average for Farm Service Agency loans, which is an agency of the USDA, was 8%. But for black farmers, it was 35%. Omawale Adewale, a farmer and co-owner of Liberation Farm in Delaware County, New York, has experienced loan discrimination firsthand. Adewale and his wife, Nadia Muib, applied for an FSA microloan of $50,000 at the Cortland County office of the USDA. The microloan program is dedicated to financing the needs of small, beginning farmers, niche, and non-traditional farm operations. They needed the money to help pay for a tractor accident the previous summer, on top of other costs. On November 17, 2023, Liberation Farm was notified they were denied the loan.
So, my wife and I was also, partnering with Liberation Farm. We're 50-50 in our partnership. You know, we both just felt exasperated. It messed with our emotions, quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And it made us feel like we wouldn't be able to do anything. So, and just knowing that this has just been, historic, situation, it's very jarring. It really makes you call the entire system into question. Farmers generally will go to the USDA for FSA loan, mm-hmm. Because it's not a traditional financial institution. And so where that'd be more stringent, harder, for you to get the funds that you need. And of course, if you're in agriculture, you kind of need, those resources for different equipment, food costs, because food has to grow. Even if folks are engaged with livestock, it has to grow. So you have to get that, that funding in early.
As a farm season can be so uncertain, access to resources and grants like FSA loans are crucial to farms staying afloat. Without them, one bad season or accident can take a huge financial toll.
If we don't have the food, as farmers, then they have to get it, somewhere else. And yeah. So I think the system then depends on that. And then that becomes the same cycle. So anytime there's a breakup or a mix up, down there where somebody is, entrepreneur down and they don't hire that many people. And now their business has to, tank. That food, is then going to just start going to a pantry, going to the supermarket, again. And so it doesn't become dependable. So now on black farmers, we can't be dependent upon, by a supermarket. You see, we can't be dependent on by a supermarket,
right?
Because we're not going to get the resources. Almost 100% of the resources go to white farmers who do livestock.
Not wanting to give up, Liberation Farm took their case to the National Court of Appeals. And on February 7th, their case was approved for a trial. They hope not only to win the appeal, but that their case will raise awareness and eventually lead to a more equitable future for other black farmers.
We want publicity, mm-hmm. on this particular issue, more publicity on the issue, but we want to make it usable data. So when I say usable data, I mean that folks first get educated and then they actually make steps to make these particular changes. And so some of these changes could be, really affecting policy. We talk to our legislators, from the local level up to, to ground level as well. Communicate with USDA, join some of these committees, and have a mindset that, we want to at least be more equitable with the distribution of, resources. So that's what we're trying to do. So it's not just for Liberation, Liberation Farm. But, for us in the short run, we want to be able to pay our bills. We want to see, that it's more fair assessment that's happening. Race kind of keeps you down, but people think that you want to be there. That's the problem. People think that you want to discuss race, like you have to. I feel like my main issue should be like everyone's main issue, which should be focused on climate change. Right now, I'd rather be, you know, discussing climate change, not race. I'd rather be focusing on bees, increasing the bees, but not being a beekeeper, just having more flowers out there, just having more ways to, you know, to grow the bee population and leave the bee population alone. Being able to, you know, just kind of learn more, you know, I feel like I don't know enough. So I want to learn more, you know, about more, you know, fungi. I want to learn more, you know, about horticulture. I want to learn more about these, you know, different elements, you know, what particular plant. I want to go forage and know what to eat and what not to eat. You know, I want to find that, you know, on the land. I want to focus on, you know, cultural, you know, issues. I feel like I can't focus on cultural issues if the political issues keep rearing its head. I would rather focus on, you know, social, you know, bonding, you know, within my community. I would love to, you know, address some of these issues, be able to heal, discuss the pain, you know, that we have generational, you know, issues that are happening, you know, there. But in a cultural setting, in a Black cultural, you know, setting, mm-hmm. you know, discussing some of those things and learn more about other cultures and find out about other cultures and see where the similarities are.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll hear how farmers are supporting one another and sharing knowledge and a job with an incredibly steep learning curve.
Thank you for all the ways you help WJFF Radio Catskill. Your support sustains the news, music, and local voices that make up WJFF. It's only possible because of your generosity. Help keep it going. Consider signing up to be a sound supporter to make sure Radio Catskill has your constant support. Go to WJFFradio.org. And thank you for supporting public radio in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.
Hi, I'm Tim Bruno, General Manager of Radio Catskill. Thanks to everyone for springing into action during our spring fun drive to help us meet our goal. We made it, thanks to you. We couldn't do it without you. And we appreciate your support for public radio for the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania. Thank you again for making our public radio station available to all. Radio Catskill. Listen local. You're listening to a special Earth Day edition of Radio Catskill. Today, Farm and Country's Rosie Starr and Radio Catskill student journalist Maren Scotton team up for a special report on the future of farming in our region. This is the future of farming.
Welcome back to the future of farming, a special presentation by Radio Catskill. We're talking to the next generation of farmers about the challenges they face entering the industry and where they hope to take it. I'm Maren Scotton.
And I'm Rosie Starr. Working hard, long hours from dawn to dusk is something that's marked farmers for generations. Farming is incredibly hard work, especially when you're struggling to stay afloat financially. On top of working overtime, first-generation farmers have to actually learn how to grow food. There are so many things to learn, so much trial and error. What grows best in what weather? How do you milk cows? For Brian Roth, a mushroom grower at Marley's Mushrooms, starting out was a learning curve. But the key was to keep trying and not to be afraid to reach out to others in the community.
The most important thing that I found with getting involved in this and becoming a farmer and making a clear change was to not let the fear hold me back. It was the most important thing. It was a new adventure, and there's a lot of information, and at times it can be overwhelming, and you never know what's going to happen. You could be running real smooth and something can just change. It doesn't mean that it's over. You just get back up and just keep on pushing. There's a lot of support out there as well, and when you think that there isn't, it's the whole industry is filled with people that are willing to help you, even if it's not a mushroom farmer. There's farmers on our markets that have given us advice and tips. stuff that they've learned of being in business for years of whatever farm that they're doing and farming. And it's been a really nice experience. It's a nice community of people that seem to help each other out. So don't be afraid and just learn and follow your passion. If it's something that you're passionate about and you enjoy, farming can be very, very, very rewarding. We do a lot of different education. We do walks for homeschools. We do events for libraries. We do private walks and public walks where you can contact us. And if you join us on a public walk, we go out to a local park in the area and we do a mushroom identification and tree identification and talk about the relationship between the fungi and the forest pathology and nature and their role. We also teach mushroom growing, how to grow at home, mushroom beds. We teach mushroom cooking with mushroom classes as well. Yeah, we have a lot of education that we offer and different things. We work with PEAK, a Pocono Environmental Education Center, and occasionally go over there and do walks as well down in with the National Park Service for bioluminescent mushroom walks at night for different mushrooms that may glow under different environments, under UV light. So yeah, we have different programs that we offer.
When Eugene Thalmann started out, he knew next to nothing. It was also seemingly a never-ending trial and error, but eventually he figured it out. He now runs a 12-acre vegetable farm called Sprouting Dreams.
I thought it was just going to be easy. I thought it was like, oh, this can't be that hard. I mean, like, I want to escape society and, you know, just live closer to nature and, you know, this can't be that hard. And then everything just wants to kill everything. So, you know what I mean? Like, I remember there was one period of time, it was like early on, we just planted something and we didn't have the dog yet. And there was just groundhogs eating stuff. And it just was like, you walk out in the morning and like you put hours in, you're not making any money. And you're just like, damn, everything's dead. Everything just got eaten. That kind of kills your spiritual vibe a little bit. You become more cynical about, like, the meaning of life and the universe. You know what I mean? Everything's dead. People have an idealized and romanticized version of farming, and I did when I started off, and I've learned the hard truths about this. Yeah, you just think it's about life. Like, you just thought, like anyone else in society, you put a plant in the ground and it grows. It's like, well, if the soil's too compacted, the roots won't spread out. If the nutrient levels aren't right, it's not going to grow well. Then you start understanding, like, really what input costs are, because you need to put things into the soil for things to do what it should do.
Brett Buddy has been farming for about 14 years, and full-time for the last six. Though he had a plot of land to work with, he started his farm from scratch, working hard, long days and nights. But he found solace in the Catskills farming community and local customer base.
We moved up here not to be farmers. We just wanted to homestead. It was during the like a big housing boom, and my wife had this property. It was simply a woodlot, and we couldn't afford anything, so we thought we would move up here and build a house. And after we were here for a while, we got some goats and some chickens, and then we started messing around with farming a little bit, and we had a lot of sheep for like 5 or 6 years. At the end, we had like probably 50 ewes. In the springtime, we'd have hundreds of babies running around, and then we had some pigs, and those were working out really well, so we ended up sticking with pigs and chickens. Yeah, we had access to land. My wife had inherited the 18 acres here, but it was literally a wood lot. And so over the last 14 years, there was 2 acres cleared and a single wide here when we moved in. And we built our house, and then we cleared maybe 3 acres by ourselves. Like in the evening, we go out and cut trees down. And, you know, after a while of doing that, I realized that I was going to grow old, like, trying to clear the land. It's just too much. And we lucked out and got somebody really cheap. I can't believe the deal I got on that. I mean, it's like one of the things I talk about, and I'm like, wow, that's like I won the lottery. So I think there is like a bit of luck in like leaving yourself open to opportunity, you know? I don't know how, like the situation is, unless you're extremely wealthy, you're going to have a small farm. Like it's not going to be a big farm. And you're in New York State, and the farming land is not like perfect like it is out in the Midwest or other places that you would be competing like in a wholesale marketplace with. So I would say, you know, most definitely the retail dollar is really important for new farmers because, first of all, you're not going to be getting wholesale pricing, and if you are, you're not going to have a massive farm to give you the scale that's required to compete, you know. And I guess that was a lesson I learned right away. But there is a lot of local support for young farmers and stuff like that in the area. I mean, the only way this farm could be successful and make money is if my local population, and we do sell down in Orange County at a farmer's market down there, so it's not all local money, but like a lot of the money that we make is from local people that realize that, you know, the product is better. It's definitely much better than what you get at the grocery store because it's living outside and it's, you know, we're growing heritage product. So I've found that like the only way to compete is try to make a super high quality product that people are willing to pay a premium for. And so that was a lesson I learned right away. There was a lot of trial and error in the first couple of years. And then finding things that have a good margin is very important, you know. And being able to do things yourself. Like, I never paid anybody to put fence up on the farm. In fact, the land clearing is the only thing I've ever paid anybody to do out here. So, you know, I learned how to drive equipment and put in roads and, you know, how to deal with that kind of stuff over time. And it wasn't like I was good at it in the beginning. But if you rent a piece of equipment for a week, by the time you're done, you're pretty okay. And then after you do it, you know, five or six times, you might even be good at it. It's really interesting right now because I think there's a lot of young people that are very interested in farming. And when I started, I didn't meet many like people starting out. You know, there were a handful of people. We in Sullivan County happen to be blessed with a fantastic Cornell Cooperative Extension, and they have, in fact, they have a young farmers program, and if you happen to be, you know, they're picking people that are sort of on their way a little bit already. I had the honor of speaking at one of the classes. It was a marketing class. And the fella that came in front of me, I was learning things from him, and I've been in the business for a long time. And I was like, man, where was this when I started? Because these classes are amazing. Yeah, the Cooperative Extension in Sullivan County has great management, and the staff are really interested in helping out new farmers. And like over the last 4 years, the CCE has really been cultivating this environment, you know, and it's really working. It's kind of like, I can't believe it. I'm so happy about it. It's really nice to see programs that are really hitting the ground and making a huge difference in Sullivan County, you know. I should mention this, the county has a revolving loan fund for farmers, and we took advantage of that for our to put the apple orchard in, and it's a great program, but like the orchard would never happened with that, and I think it would have been pretty hard for me to get a loan from a bank to put in a U-pick orchard in Sullivan County where there's no U-pick orchards. There's nothing before you to point to say that this is going to work as a business, and You know, it was a 10-year loan, and we paid it off in 7 years. And it's that program, the interest rates are really reasonable, and it's like one of these things. And none of this young new farmer stuff actually happens in a vacuum. It really takes the support of CCE and. You know, my wife and I have gotten numerous grants and loans from different organizations. I'm pretty sure we got one from Pure Catskills. It wasn't a gigantic loan, but it was really helpful getting us together with some of our, we spent a good bit of the money on marketing type stuff, and it really helped, you know. So, but, like, it takes these organizations to, like, help these young farmers start out. And so I don't know what it's like to live in big farm country, but I can't imagine there's the same amount of camaraderie. You know, people are loaning people equipment, giving great advice, really offering to lend a helping hand. You know, it's super cool.
The Cornell Cooperative Extension Buddy's talking about recently launched a new beginner farmers program, which assists beginner farmers in the Hudson Valley region through group training, one-on-one conversations, farm visits, and mentorship.
Taylor Adam, the program's manager, says it was designed to welcome new farmers into the community and create a space where they could feel comfortable asking questions and learning the ropes. Adam, who was a farmer herself before this position, acts as a resource for anyone in the Catskills area interested in learning more about farming.
The Beginner Farmer Program was created by myself, the extension office here, and the Ag and Food Systems team really felt a need for like something specific that supported beginner farmers based on the number of inquiries they were getting in from beginner farmers specifically. So they applied for a grant with the USDA, and they got it. It's a grant through the American Rescue Plan Technical Assistance Program. Really long name. That's what the USDA does, but it's called ARPDA, and it's funding the program until at least 2027. There's a bunch of other organizations throughout the country and territories of the United States that are also funded by this program, and it's also technical assistance for farmers in a variety of different ways. But because of the funding, there's a lot of really cool pieces for the program that we at Extension weren't able to do before. So because the amount of funding we received, we're able to like pay farmers for their time and labor with their involvement in the program. So, for example, we have a bunch of different pieces, but we have a mentorship program, which is farmer to farmer mentoring, and we pay our mentor farmers an hourly rate. And then the mentees get a $10,000 stipend in quarterly installments throughout the year.
Thalman of Sprouting Dreams Farm is one of those mentors.
I'm a mentor, and there's 10 others. There's 10 spots available per year, and then there's 10 mentees. The mentees are getting a stipend to put into the farms they're developing, and the mentors are getting paid to help guide these real beginning farmers or startup farms into getting into production and capacity to grow. So, you know, there's an application process. The cohorts are a year long. And, I mean, it's great for everybody. I mean, like, I'm going to take the money that I'm getting paid to put into my business. And, you know, right there, when you are going to be able to just put that money into your business, it will create economic trickle-down for our community. I've been going to my mentee's farm monthly, and we're watching his farm grow. I mean, like, one thing was, like, you know, he put screws through the faceplate at like the 3 or 4 foot level, and he used larger screws, and I'm like, hey man, you should just nip these off. These are a safety issue. So it's little things like that. Sometimes it's like, how are you going to interact with the person that's still haying this field? Like, how are you going to change that? How are we going to be polite? How are we going to maintain relationships with community members who are farming your land? Or just everything that I've kind of learned. Like, for instance, this individual was going to use an inductive element heater. And I said, like, that's really, like, blast heat. because he's so early on infrastructure. Like, we're talking here, like, I have power and water and heat in a way that would manage a residence. You know what I mean? This is now, you know, someone who just got their first barn built and a service just put in and still digging the well. And then it goes back to, like, reminding me where I was. Like, 2 years ago, 2 winters ago, or 3 winters ago, I was rolling a hose to fill up a giant container in these high tunnels because I didn't have frost-free lines yet. And you think about it, like, I went through this. I mean, it's great for me, too. I mean, we speak on the phone once a week, and we just go through, like, okay, what did you get done this week? Like, what am I working on? And, you know, even just talking about what I've learned, too. I mean, like, hey, what's your issue? Why is it going slow? You know, the job can go by so much faster. So, yeah, there's a lot of shortcuts. There's a lot of also, like, yeah, I've been there. My family thought I was crazy. Mm-hmm. Like, everyone thought I was nuts when I started. Like, yeah, you got to prove yourself. And you know what? There's another great quote, too. It's, I don't know who says it, but it's, too many people who are starting a business get to the point and just quit a little too soon. Because there was some points where, like, yeah, it wasn't working. It was totally hard. Like, when I started this, I knew almost nothing. Like, I knew how to read a textbook. I barely knew how to work hard, right? And at this point now, it's like, I know how to build a house, and I know how to work all day, every day if I had to. I mean, I wish that this was something that happened when I was a kid. When I was graduating high school, the societal push was everyone goes to college. We need to open up the pathways for children to do things that are going to benefit society and produce more holistically minded individuals.
For Adam, it's all about creating a welcome environment for anyone interested in farming, particularly historically underserved farmers, which includes Black and Indigenous farmers, people of color, women, and LGBTQ+ farmers.
The reality that it's harder for folks who might not identify as, like, male or white to really enter the farming world, and trying to make sure that this program supports that and helps break down any barriers that it might have been up for folks before. It can feel, like, really exclusive, I think. From, like, a personal perspective, I mean, I'm a white woman, so I have a lot of privilege, but it was even rare to see other women in farming. I really had to, like, go out there and find that. And I was really lucky I was around a community of female or, like, femme farmers. But I think it can be really exclusive if you don't, like, look the look of, like, what farmers traditionally have looked like in the past or really big successful operations have looked like in the past. Like, with these networking events, I'm really trying to, like, create an environment that anyone who's interested in farming feels welcome and that they can come into this environment and, like, have their questions answered or, like, meet someone else. But also knowing that, like, they are welcomed in general into the agricultural community. Yeah, it's, like, really hard to get into farming, especially if you don't come from a background or, like, a family setup that has money to support you to get into that. That's really hard. It's a lot of, like, independent work to really set yourself up. And farming jobs do not pay enough. Yeah. So there's not really a lot of saving you can do beforehand if you're a career farmer going into owning and operating your own business. Yeah, and I guess the other thing is, like, I'm just always a resource. So if you're nervous to come to an event, or just, like, want to start talking about farming or, like, how to get started, like, I'm always here to talk about it. Run through ideas. I can come out to your property, like, whatever feels helpful for you. I'm just here to support.
Like the Cornell Cooperative Extension, PASA also has a program designed for people interested in farming as a career. It is a formal apprenticeship program where beginner farmers are paired with a host farmer and are taught the ins and outs and farm business management.
When we went to do our curriculum development for our apprenticeship program, we worked with a professional facilitator who works with, you know, many different industries. And when we got to the end, you know, she reflected that it was by far the largest career articulation that she had ever done. And, you know, sort of in thinking about it, you realize, yeah, you know, in other trades and in other industries, there's a sort of ladder of progression, right? entry level, mid-career, management level, and so on. And there's sort of steps within that. But in farming, you know, especially farm ownership, farm management, professional management, things like that, you really have to know everything on day one in order to make it all go, be successful. And so, yeah, we have an incredibly long, for that program in particular, 192 skills across 18 areas that trainees are learning around. And it is very robust, but it's also in response to just how involved diversified farming is. I do like to uphold and mention our research program. I think that that has a really interesting both connection to our founding ethos and highlights a really interesting way forward. So the core right now, our primary and largest study is our soil health benchmark study. And it is, I think we're across 9 or more states at this point through partnerships and other things like that. But it's basically a large, ongoing, indefinite study where we're looking at soil health outcomes on a range of different farms. So we know that soil health and soil carbon and things like that are connected to climate change, but also to agricultural production more broadly. And the Soil Health Benchmark study gives farmers access to a really robust soil testing regime and gives them a very robust report back on a number of metrics about their soil's health. But it also gives them anonymized insights into peer farmers, so other folks in similar farming systems who are peers to them, so that they're able to compare themselves to each other and to find insights on ways to further improve their soil health over time. And then they also receive a summary of the entire study and all of the cohorts aggregated together. And again, to compare themselves against the wider soil health audience. We don't have a deadline or an end date for that study, and we don't have a hypothesis. So it's a little bit different than traditional academic research. We're really just providing the sampling services and processing and all of that and collecting the records and then reflecting back to the farmers the outcomes of their practices. One of the things, the values that we add to that is trying to draw out specific insights. What we're able to see kind of with the view of all of that data, what is working for many farmers or many farmers within a segment, and then to reflect that back to them in the form of programming. So that might be a conference session, that might be a field day or a workshop or something like that. But all in the service of continuous improvement. And, you know, through this benchmarking and this tracking and these peer networks, highlighting ways forward to advance soil health across, you know, the entire audience for that study. So I find that really powerful. We also try to use those insights for our trainee farmers. Here are lessons that you can take and apply to your own future farming goals, and then try to share out with our membership more broadly as well. So that's something from the research program that I think is really powerful.
You've been listening to The Future of Farming, a special presentation from Radio Catskill.
Thank you to all the farmers who shared their stories with us. Despite all the challenges, it is clear the next generation of farmers in New York and Pennsylvania are a determined, tight-knit community, and the future of the industry is in good hands.
And thank you for listening. If you're interested in farming, be sure to check out PASA Sustainable Agriculture and the Cornell Cooperative Extension Program to learn more. I'm Maren Scotton, an intern for Radio Catskill.
And I'm Rosie Starr, host of Farm and Country. Be sure to tune in every Saturday at 10 a.m. on Radio Catskill when Farm and Country highlights topical issues on rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from The Furniture Restore, located on Main Street in Jeffersonville, specializing in antique and vintage furniture, rugs, art, and lighting, because buying well-made and pre-owned is a better choice for the planet. Winter hours online at therestorejville.com. And from The River Reporter, the community newspaper serving 4 counties along the Delaware River in Pennsylvania and New York, riverreporter.com. And from listeners like you.
Former President Trump is in real legal trouble, facing multiple serious criminal charges, all while he runs for president again. I'm Scott Detrow. Each week on All Things Considered, we dive into the latest courtroom drama and consider the stakes for American democracy. Catch up with us every Saturday or listen to the Trump's Trials podcast from NPR. And stay with this NPR station for breaking updates and analysis.
Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.